And welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron at www.thematthewaaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter, The Matthew Aaron Show on Facebook. You can go to that page and you can like it. Go to the page and like it. And then Matthew Aaron Show is also on iTunes. Leave some comments or do whatever you want to do. They can be bad comments. I don't care.
It happens. What are you going to do?
It happens. I'm Matthew Aaron. I am with
Mr. Mikey Terzo.
And we're going to be joined here in a second by Roxanne, who will leave her last name out of
it. Yeah, we won't bring that
because
up.
Because we have some very interesting questions. We're here from
if it's a real name.
We're here from Cigars and Stripes over on in Berwyn on Ogden. What's the address here? No one knows the address?
It's on Ogden and Berwyn. It's Cigars and Stripes. Look it up. You'll find it.
I like how Mikey treats our listeners like they're not idiots. Look it up.
Look, we're in the information age. It's not hard to find it out.
It's 6715 Ogden Avenue. Thank you, Caesar Marconi.
Thank you, Caesar.
He's using his Wi-Fi on his phone because we've decided to do this like the Stone Age and have no Wi-Fi for the show. So we're outdoors. This is nice. It's, you know, why haven't we done more location shoots?
Why don't you ask yourself that question?
I'm lazy.
Yeah.
Let's just be honest. It's
me that
has packed the equipment. It's me that has to undo the equipment. It's me.
Hold on.
It's annoying.
We always offer to help.
Yes, you were really offering with that Schlitz in your hand over in the corner there, talking bullshit over in the corner. Yeah, it
well,
was
I was
a lot
talking
of help.
To I was talking to our guest.
Oh. What I want to talk about with Roxanne is she does the laser treatments. Okay. Well, you got to talk into a microphone. You can't just like say laser hair removal.
She said she looks at BHs all day. I'm not sure.
Let's get to that. Okay, go ahead, Roxanne. What do you do for
what's
a living?
What's a BH?
Let's start. What do you do for a living?
Hair removal on all areas of the body, head to toe.
Okay. Now, what is that? Head to toe.
Yeah, head to toe.
And she did tell us before, head to toe, how much does a head to toe laser removal cost?
$10,000, full body.
$10,000.
Now, that's multiple treatments, right?
Treatment is 10 treatments, and it's 10 treatments. And you have to wait 6 to 8 weeks for between each treatment.
So it takes you over a year.
So it's not just one time. You got to go. You got to keep going because the hair will grow back.
Is this a different kind of laser treatment than any other kind of laser treatment? Can you go to a laser treatment place and get it done in one time?
No. Laser hair removal, no. There are different types of laser treatments. Like you can go and get vein removal, tattoo removal, but we...
Hair removal.
Very interesting. So Mikey had some interesting questions, I remember.
Yeah, she said she looks at BHs all day.
What's a BH,
what's
Roxanne?
A BH?
What's a BH?
I will not say.
Does it have anything to do with buttholes?
Yes.
Okay. All right. All right.
I am a lady, so I will not say what BH stands for.
Yes.
So you do this in Boys Town, predominantly gay communities, so most of the men that come in are gay. They like to have the laser treatment done on all areas.
Yes, a lot of guys come in for their beards or their...
What's a beard?
Their face.
For their facial beard?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know if you meant their fake wife. Like Oprah and Gayle.
Wow.
Well, like Oprah and Stedman. Oprah's got a beard, Stedman, and then she's got Gayle on the side.
Yep.
Allegedly. Continue. So they come in, they get their beards done, and they get their chest done and whatever. Is it painful?
Oh, so painful. Like
really?
Yeah, it's really painful.
Do you know what the pain feels like?
It's a hot rubber band snap.
Oh,
that's interesting.
So how
that's kind of kinky.
I thought everyone does this because it's less painful than waxing. Why is this, instead of waxing,
honestly, I've had my underarms waxed, and I've had my underarms lasered, obviously. I would much rather, I've had my rib cage tattooed. I would much rather get my rib cage tattooed than waxed.
Oof.
The first time you get your underarms or any area... lasered the first time is really painful, but the more treatments you get, the less painful it is.
Wow. Okay.
No, you're not used to the pain. The hair gets it thins out.
And once again, now that we're talking about buttholes and lasering and blah, 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 I think it's a perfect time to remind our audience to stay tuned for the Billy Friedkin interview. Oscar winner Billy Friedkin of The Exorcist, French Connection,
and
Chips,
Joe Carnahan,
and Killer Joe, which came out last week.
Okay.
Killer Joe, which you can see downtown, and Joe Carnahan is going to be a caller during that interview. Okay, so back to this, because I'm curious. Okay. So what are some of the, like, worst situations you've been in when doing this type of treatment? She's laughing.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories going through her head right now. We can see. By the way, I just want to say for our fans in
discretion, okay?
I just want to say for our fans in Kosovo, I don't know if they have hair removal, but
our fans in Kosovo, one of them emailed me today.
Oh, did they?
One of them emailed me today and says we should make a film in Kosovo because they've been at war 100 years. There's a really interesting film there. They wanted me to know.
Okay. Well, we'll get on that.
We're getting right on it. So Roxanne, tell us some stories about laser hair removal that people would be like, wow, I can't believe that happened. Like, for instance, you said men get laser hair removal everywhere. Everywhere, right? She's on her phone.
Everywhere.
Calm down with the phone. Yap into the mic.
Okay.
Tell me about everywhere.
I mean, do you have a certain question? I mean, be more specific. I work with discretion.
Adam has a question.
Okay.
Our sound engineer, Adam, has a question. Go ahead.
Before we started recording, you were starting to talk about, you can get your inner ass cheek lasered, like basically your butt crevice. Can you actually get your nut sack lasered, and is that the worst thing for a male? That is a very sensitive area.
It is very sensitive and very painful. If I were a guy, I would not do it. Most guys who come in to get it done, that's my phone quacking. guys who come in to get it, a lot of them use lidocaine, which is prescription.
Got a lot of ducks over there.
prescription strength numbing cream. I don't know how guys do it because it is so painful, and when they are doing it, most of them are dying with each laser, strike.
Oh.
Is it
like a laser strike, like, per hair?
The head of the laser is about 2 inches long, so...
we got something in common.
With laser hair removal, you have to overlap 50%. So you shoot the laser. It's not like a continual pain. It's like you shoot the laser and it hurts right that second. But once that spot is done, it doesn't hurt anymore. It's not like continual pain.
So it's not like when you get waxed,
like,
it hurts like a day later.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So let's put it this way. To rephrase Matt's question. Now, these may not be experiences that you've had, but what are some of the stories that some of your co-workers could tell you about that were very interesting?
Well, a very stinky BH.
Oh.
That's never good.
I almost threw up on a client because the BH was hit you in the face. It wasn't even...
So did this BH have some habanero meatloaf before coming in?
Not from Cigars and Stripes.
I mean, not that I know of, but... She was on her side holding one butt cheek open, and I had it's up to, obviously you're wearing gloves and you're very cautious and everything like that, but
you didn't have the gas mask on that day.
I had the mask on.
Oh my God.
It went through the mask.
Honestly, when I'm doing somebody's
black Volkswagen. Who's got a black Volkswagen? There we go. There we go. Caesar's blocking off the lot. Okay, continue.
Men, women, when they're coming in for their treatments, they're not as courteous as they should be, and it'll just hit you in the face.
Now,
I mean, it's a BH. What do you want?
Now, I'm just going to throw this out here. This sounds like you got a lot of guys coming in, a lot of gay men, You know, there's pain involved, private areas. This sounds like it can get pretty kinky. I mean, do you have any guys you think maybe enjoy this?
Wait, what part of this sounds pretty kinky?
I'm just saying there's a lot of weirdos out there.
Hot rubber bands to the
I have some friends and some interesting businesses, and you'd be surprised what some guys like.
I agree. There's some freaky stuff.
I mean, I've been shocked.
Like I told you guys, the FUQ.com, there's some freaky shit out there.
I mean, I've seen guys with, you know, they grab saran wrap, high heels, and a hooker, and they're having a great time, and they're not, you know.
Was I right about that website, by the way? They got everything?
Well,
they got everything?
Okay, so we have this one client who, so I was talking to my friend Lenny earlier saying, have you ever seen that show, Boardwalk Empire, where there's that one guy who, like, beats himself in the back? And he has scars all over his back, and he, like, gets off from it.
FBI agent.
Yeah. So, it's kind of the same thing. There's this one person who comes in, and he gets his balls. Can I say balls?
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
He gets his balls lasered, okay? So, you would think that it would be so, it's so painful, you would not be aroused by this, or, you know, it would not register in your brain to get a boner. This guy gets off from it, so...
He totally gets off from it.
Like,
he gets a boner, and he
finishes.
And he finishes?
100%. Finishes.
And he comes in, what, twice a week?
No, six to eight weeks, and he's gay. He's gay, and it's a girl doing the treatment.
So obviously he's into the pain.
That's what I think. I mean, what else could it be?
Oh, man, that's brutal.
Apparently my life is not exciting enough.
I got to tell you, Mikey, people are into some weird shit, man. Some crazy shit. So
yeah.
women get these laser treatments, too. Now, what happens? Do women ever want to get, like, any kind of, like, weird treatment? Like, there's no hair that grows, like, so close inside that you would need to get treatment there.
What do you mean inside?
Like, when they spread their legs.
Like
what?
Labia?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really? Oh, that's got to be...
Woman?
How? Yeah, but how painful is that got
to
be?
It's painful. And those are the most painful areas when you have to go inside the labia.
Oh, wow.
Hair
that was my big question because, I mean, like... And, I mean, if you're a guy and you've ever gone down on a woman and you come up with a hairball, that's kind of...
A hairball?
Oh, you've never had that? Where sometimes guys don't like doing this in front of women because it's kind of, like, demeaning, but we'll walk away and we'll be like... You know, get a hairball.
I have a feeling that Roxanne doesn't have that problem. She works
back to the throat. Exactly.
She works at a laser hair removal place. I'm sure that.
No hair.
Oh God.
Well, Lenny, Roxanne was saying women get their labias lasered.
That's just painful. How? Could you please show us?
you wish.
I'm sure. As she stated earlier, she doesn't have any problems with hair.
For women, most women who come in, usually the number one area I would say was your lip for women.
Yeah.
No, your lip on your face. And then underarms and bikini. But when you're getting your bikini done, the sides, it's painful, but it's not as bad. But when you get to, like, the top, right at, like, where the...
Ronnie's making jokes.
No. Just keep
Continue.
Talking. Keep talking.
It's Ronnie Lotz, the owner of Cigars and Stripes.
Yeah, he makes an appearance once in a while.
Yes, he makes funny little jokes.
All right,
not much different than Mike Binder does at Coney Dog.
Right when you get to the top of the labia and then right directly the sides and right inside is the most painful.
Could you point
and
down a little bit more?
When you're further down back, when it starts getting darker for some people, like... Their BH.
Oh.
Then it gets more painful.
Wow.
Yeah.
A lot
of girls have darker areas.
You know,
and you did say it's predominantly Indian women, right?
A lot of Indian women do come in.
Okay.
Now, I just want to throw
That's
this out
something
here.
Something we need to know.
Folks, fans out there, I just want to say, welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. Where we are the only ones that can make laser hair removal turn you on.
By the way, I noticed my father, like, disappeared. He obviously
hates
the show. Yeah, Roxanne was a little shy talking about buttholes in front of my dad.
The BH, please?
Yeah, the BH. I love how you're so sensitive to these words because you got to deal with them every day.
Every day.
Ronnie,
When they're smacking you in the face from the smell.
She does laser removal. Ronnie, she does laser removal on buttholes. In Boys Town.
It's just like
that's her job.
If you don't like, here.
So you though request that you don't want, you don't
compliments want, to Ronnie.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Compliments to Ronnie Lotz with the Schlitz beer. Thank you, Ronnie.
Thank you, Ronnie.
all right, now Roxanne, you request not to get men for your laser removal. Is there a reason why?
Yeah, because I don't want him coming on the table.
So after you heard that story, that was like it for you.
My dad freaked out because I like.
You told your dad?
Why would you tell your dad?
How did you tell your dad? The more important question. How do you tell your father that story?
Well, this guy came on the table.
You guys are over at D'Agostino's having some pasta. How does this come up?
Well, I mean, he's my dad. I have to tell him. Like,
you have to tell him some gay guy got a boner and came on the table.
He freaked out. He was so pissed.
Wait,
he's
but,
like,
okay,
you
I'm your
that job right now.
Wait, Roxanne, I'm your dad. Talk to me like I'm your dad. How'd you tell him? Tell me. Roxanne, how was your day at work? How is work today?
Well, I had to laser this gay guy's boner.
I'll be her dad. Oh my God, she works in a whorehouse.
Wait, but it's
we
just,
can't even tell. It's like a rule in my family. We can't even tell my grandma what I do because she's like, she will cry. She's 89 years old, and everyone is like, do not tell grandma.
You never
she
tell your
mom. Heart attack and die.
You do not tell your mom.
Here's a question. You see naked people all the time.
Oh, wait, I have a
yeah.
story.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Speaking of, you see naked people all the time.
Yeah.
We have this one client who comes in. She is Indian.
Okay.
She's got the full headdress on.
Yeah.
She comes in the office, and we're like, okay, so, you know, we put the clients into their room, and we give them a cover, like a paper cover-up. It's like a, I don't even know how to explain it. Just like a
paper ground or something.
Something like that. And a paper bikini.
Okay.
To protect their modesty. So obviously we give them about 5 to 10 minutes to get unchanged if you know, if they're doing everything like that. So we put this one client in her room and she's like, you have to leave the room while I'm getting undressed. And we're like, okay, well, I'm going to do that, but at the same time, I'm about to laser your hooch, so what does it matter if I see you without your headdress on? Like,
do you ever get aroused or judge your own cleanliness by the women you...
Thank you, Leonard Cannata. Thank you, Leonard. We're
my
trying...
cleanliness?
I'm listening to a story about an Indian broad, and you're jumping in going, so did you get aroused by the Indian broad taking off her underwear?
Know. Sometimes, I mean, guys compare penis sizes much in the same way that... You know, women might compare the...
Well, we're getting to that.
Or how flat
well,
the ladies are.
I'm rocking with the laser head, so, you know.
We're getting
if
to
they're
that.
Rocking some beef curtains, you never know.
We're getting to that. But go ahead, Roxanne. Continue your story, and you can
answer can I ask Roxas, because I love her too much, so I will not.
She's. You already asked it, you moron. All right, Roxanne, continue. Continue.
Yeah, I was
you can answer Lenny's question.
I was a little thrown off by the fact that she wanted me to leave the room while she got unchanged when I was just about to see her whole hooch.
Let me ask you this. So you see naked people all the time. Okay. And so predominantly are these like good-looking people, or do you like look at some of these people and you're like, oh, my God, this is so fucking gross?
50-50.
50-50? Like, are you ever jealous of a woman that comes in and takes off all her clothes and you're like, wow, what a rockin' bod?
I'm never jealous, but I do think to myself, she has a good body.
She has a rockin' bod. Yeah. I think that's an important question. Mikey, any questions on the nudity front? Oh, have you ever seen any guys who have, like, real small ones and you kind of just don't want to laugh, but you're laughing? Yeah, guys.
I've had one guy, and I refuse to take any more.
So that was the one. That was it. One and done.
Yeah.
On the guy front.
But the thing is about guys, I have clients who come in to get a full T-shirt, which is front and back.
Yeah.
Front chest and back of whatever their back. I'll give them 3 minutes to get changed or whatever, you know, to get settled on the table. It's all clinical, so, you know, it's like a doctor's office,
yeah.
Pretty much. It's very clean, very, you know, sanitary, whatever. I'll give them 3 to 5 minutes to get changed, and they'll just get, like, T-shirt or, like, back, and I'll walk in the room, and they'll have no pants on. And I'm like, why obviously you have no pants on. I am just lasering your back. Like, what the hell is going on?
What was the comment? What did they say when you say that?
I don't say that to them. I need to be professional and discreet, you know, but it's like, what is going on in their mind?
Do they put the pants on when you laser them?
No.
So they just decide they're going to get buck ass. Okay.
Well, it's a doctor's office. I mean, normally you go to a doctor's
what,
office.
Lenny?
They say put the gown down. Yeah.
Oh. Lenny, I was talking about nudity here. People are interested.
Well, you know what?
Lenny's like, keep the show moving. Listen. No, hold on. This is important.
People are just getting flanked by your
entire I'm going to tell you guys something. I'm going to tell you guys something right now. You already heard this story for an hour over there. You don't give a flying fuck anymore. People listening care. They want to hear about this shit. It's interesting. I mean, this happens all the time, though. We'll do a show, and we've already talked about something for 30 minutes before the show. So then we do it on the show, and then everyone's like, after 5 minutes, okay, let's move on. People want to hear this. This isn't for us. This is for them.
For the fans in Kosovo.
Yes, this is important. Kosovars want to know about nudity at the look, it's interesting. All right, now let me ask you this.
I'd like a psychiatrist.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is your job, like, harming you mentally at all?
No, it's not harming me mentally. Because,
no.
I mean, I'm fine with it all, but...
You get health and dental there?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good.
I do. But people come in, and they get butt-ass naked, and they think I am their psychiatrist. Like, they tell
me they talk to you?
Dark secrets. 100.
They talk? So, wait, they like, lay out on the table and,
100.
Like, let it rip?
Like 2 weeks ago, was like, oh, so I went to my dentist last week, and you'll never believe what happened. And I'm like, oh, not fishing or anything like that. I don't want to know. Like, you know, she's like, well, my hygienist was asking me about my life, so I told her I was having an affair with this married man. And I'm like, oh, okay, and didn't want to ask any more questions or inquire further. And she's like, well, then she told my mother, and I'm like, okay, sorry to hear that. And she's like, well, then I wrote my dentist a letter, and he fired her.
What?
I'm like, okay. So,
do they ever ask you for advice?
Absolutely.
All the time?
Yeah, all the time.
So this is like, how long is the procedure? Like an hour?
It depends on the area, like a lip on your face.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lip on your face.
Well, there's lips other places,
too. It
takes
about 5 minutes.
Five,
your underarm,
okay.
7 minutes, prep and finish.
Man.
You gotta prep the skin, you gotta put the gel on, you gotta laser it, you gotta clean up the skin.
Oh, man.
How much for a chest?
Yeah, for this. $7,000.
Yeah. So now, personally, though, Roxanne, because you've worked at this place and you're in laser treatment, are you into men with hair on their body at all? Is that a thing that turns you off now? Or do you like hair?
What do you mean?
Do you mind do you mind hair on a guy's body now?
I mean, I'm Italian.
Yeah.
And so, I mean.
So it just goes with the territory.
Yeah.
And you're not going to tell some guy to go get waxed. Are there any other genders, ages, or nationalities that are way hairier than others? That's a good question. That's a good question. That wasn't mine. That was a good question, though.
You said there's a lot of Indians that come in. Indian women.
There are a lot of Indians.
Women. Indian women.
Indian women. Indian women are definitely hairier.
Okay.
The majority of Indian women definitely get their full face, whereas Caucasian white women usually just get like an upper lip or a chin. Or both.
So let me ask you this. This is my last question I have about this, and then if Mikey or anyone else has a question. My last question is, do you hear any crazy stories since you stopped doing it for men? All you girls talk over there, obviously, and stuff. Do you hear any crazy stories, and you're like, thank God I stopped doing that?
You're trying to pull this story out of me, aren't you?
I am.
Okay.
I am.
All right. Well, there's a gay man that comes in to get his area, his private area lasered.
Balls.
Yes, balls, Lenny. Yes, you can. Yeah, go ahead.
Like,
go ahead.
Okay, well, so he's 100% gay, likes men. A woman is doing his treatment, and he gets a full-on erection during his treatment.
Yes.
And finishes by the end of it.
Oh, we've told that story, didn't we? But I wanted to hear the story about the guy that's married. The guy that's married that comes in. Tell me that story.
He's married.
But you thought he was gay. He had to be gay.
Well, I mean, he's getting his full body lasered, full legs.
T-shirt, all of it.
Front, back, balls, ass.
BH.
Everything.
BH.
He's got everything lasered, so for sure I thought he was gay. He's got two kids and a wife. So I'm thinking he's got a sick fetish.
Yeah.
I don't know, though. I mean, to each their own. Like,
but
maybe
the sick fetish
really
only lasts for like a year and a half. You got to find something new after that.
And not only that, but like, if you're a woman dating a guy and hair is that important, it's like a deal breaker. So
it
you'll
is.
Break up with that person.
So his wife has to think he's weird.
Or maybe his wife just truly loves his person and doesn't like the hair. But if it were me and I was dating someone who was that hairy and I didn't like the hair, I would break up with them.
Well, Roxanne, thank you very much. We have now been educated, which I don't think any other show does this. We've now been educated on laser hair removal.
Yeah, so far, laser hair removal. This is like a massage parlor.
We're not getting waxed.
No.
I'm not getting
no.
waxed, and I ain't getting no laser hair removal.
It's
no.
clinical. It's clinical.
Oh,
happy ending.
Yeah, no happy ending. Well, apparently
for one guy
gets a happy ending every time he comes.
Mikey, you got any more questions for Roxanne?
No, I'm good.
Okay, so moving on. Let's see what else is going on. Oh, my health problems. Going to the doctor tomorrow, Mikey. I'm pretty sure I'm going to die. Yeah, pretty sure. I don't know. I got really weird about it today. I called. You're good. I called my doctor today. They asked me what was wrong. I said, you know, I got it. Like I talked about on the show last week, I got pissed like 50 times in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
I got a pain in my left side. Yeah, other problems.
I still think it might be prostate.
They gave me a bunch of options. Prostate was one of them. Kidneys, another one. Diabetes is one. And extreme stress. So I'm going in for blood work tomorrow. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to spend some time in the hospital, too, for this sleep apnea machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it's not a hospital. You got to go to, like, a special...
It's called a sleep study.
Yeah. I know it works. My dad uses it. It's great.
Oh, he has a CPAP machine?
Yeah. Huh? It could just be stress. That's what they said. They said it could be extreme stress. So I'll find out when the blood work gets back. What's up? Yeah, no, go ahead, talk. What's up? Roxanne's got more to talk about. It's on. It's on. You're good.
Okay. Are you, I'm not a doctor, but are you losing sleep?
Yes, bad insomnia.
But is it because of the new recent developments? Like you're just stressed out about what could be?
It's been getting...
Was it before that?
I don't think I'm extremely stressed. They do. But I probably am. But the thing is, it was bad a year ago. It's been getting slowly worse ever since. I've always had problems sleeping. It's
okay.
Getting way worse.
All right.
Yeah. And the peeing in the middle of the night thing. And then I don't really even have to pee. Like, I'll go to pee and barely anything comes out.
Okay.
But I feel like I got to pee like a gallon.
Right.
So we're going to find out about that.
You got to laser your asshole. You'll be fine.
But if I die, this is a good show to
die on.
Because we got Billy Friedkin in a minute here. And
you're not going to die.
Yeah, well,
you know,
we'll see. Oh, there's Ronnie. Let's see if Ronnie come over
Ronnie
and promote
Lutz.
His
Ronnie
place.
Lutz, everybody.
Ronnie Lutz, who, if you're a listener of the show, you've heard on the show a bunch of times. But Ronnie, we're plugging the joint here, huh? We're plugging the joint.
This is the man of the hour.
And Ronnie doesn't care to come plug. What's always my problem?
Probably easily 1,500 fucking pounds of men here. A 12-pack of Schlitz, and you guys are just looking at it. I don't fucking get it.
Well, we're almost done with it.
Wait,
is that yours over there? What's that one?
It's not mine. I didn't put my...
Oh, that's yours? Is there still beer in there?
I'm not putting my fucking lips on any of that bullshit.
So, Ronnie, we're talking about cigars. You got Monday night's wrestling night. You got the WrestleManias. You play the Summer Slams, the old classics. Tuesday night, you got movie night. Wednesday night, you got comedy night. Saturday, sometimes you have music acts, or sometimes you have comedy night, or sometimes you got all sorts of things.
Yeah, primarily it's comedy every Wednesday and Saturday for over six goddamn years.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that's great. I mean, and by the way, as Mikey said and as I've said, the food here, there's no menu. You don't walk in, you don't get a menu. It's whatever Ronnie feels like fucking making.
All right, are you guys gonna sample that hop? I made one extra habanero. Oh, he cut it up already.
I'm waiting. I'm ready.
Listen,
I'm waiting.
I'm not kidding with you, man. I put like 30 habaneros in this fucking thing because you guys have been complaining about it. You came in here. You did like the triple play. You had everything. You had the rib tips. You had the fucking beef. You had the pizza.
Yep. I had the pulled pork. The pulled pork.
Pulled pork. Yeah.
And guys, everything here, just to give you an idea, Ronnie grows his own peppers to make his own hot sauce all here. Smokes all his own meats. It's unbelievable. When they have those signs that you see in Chicago that says, Berwyn, Chicago's best kept secret, that's only because of Cigars and Stripes.
It's not because of the Starbucks down the... No, there is no Starbucks in this area. It's all Mexicans.
So is this your normal show? Is this what you guys normally do?
Ronnie, you've been on the show a billion times.
Well, I phone,
never live.
I phone in, man.
Yeah, this is how it is live for the most part.
This is it.
It's a train wreck. Yeah.
Right here?
Yeah, it's this train wreck.
There was like 14 people here. Oh, they're over there now. What was with that girl? Man, who's that girl?
She does laser hair removal.
Ugh.
Yeah.
God, man, that fucking voice. Who's dating her?
Lenny. That's Lenny's girl.
Who's Lenny?
Lenny. Big Len.
Len.
Oh, you're moving on.
We're talking about your girlfriend.
Listen to me. I hear...
No girlfriend.
You hear that fucking voice?
All right.
Listen, when I hear that goddamn voice, I just picture a screen door opening and her leaning out going, you come home with a gallon of milk, you motherfucker. At 5:30, I want to see that car in the fucking driveway. What? Oh, good. Whatever. Hey, listen, I don't know what to tell you, man. Oh, Jesus. Well, whatever.
You do have a nagging wife voice.
Listen.
It's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, why don't you hear it?
I hear a voice like that, I go back to like I'm a kid. You know what I'm saying? The dad pulls in the fucking driveway. The doggy goes directly from underneath the fucking couch. Party's over. You know what I mean? The whole family's getting a fucking... That voice of yours is horrifying. I'm sorry. It's terrible.
She doesn't want to talk now. She grabbed the mic. Oh, come on, Roxanne. We love you.
100, I know that my voice is so high-pitched. But I can't fucking help it, okay? And I will, like, you could ask my boyfriend right now. I am the least bitch girlfriend ever. I don't give one. Ew.
Ronnie's saying ew over it.
You bring a gallon of milk, motherfucker.
You
know, the screen door's got a big rip in it. You know what I mean? It's in like I see a fucking mobile home.
Roxanne, just one time for me. Can you just say, bring home a gallon of milk, you motherfucker?
Yeah.
Go do whatever the fuck you want as long as you're coming home to me. I don't give one fuck what you're doing.
Oh, my God.
And get the eggs.
Well, listen to me. Hey, who's your guest today? Anyway,
Billy Friedkin.
The Exorcist.
French Connection.
Holy shit.
The Sorcerer.
French Connection was one of the greatest auto chases of all fucking time.
Yeah, he's the king of those. That's his thing.
Hey.
Say it again.
I just want to throw this out just for Roxanne's confidence. She is gorgeous, though, right?
I don't know.
Well, Matt. Ronnie's married. He's out of the picture.
If I knew what I knew about fucking women now, when I was in high school, I'd have been a fucking queer.
Ronnie.
Listen to me. I'd have been on the goddamn wrestling team and everything. I'm not fucking kidding. Oh, yeah. Fuck yeah. Fuck yes. Oh, yeah.
I was telling her before, doesn't she kind of look like a young Betty Lauren Maltese?
Absolutely wouldn't know. When we were kids, we were 12 years old, we used to go to French 75 over there and try to peek in the fucking windows and see titties all the time. Jump on the bicycles, the banana seats, and look in the window. She used to strip over there, I heard. I don't fucking know.
Allegedly, Black Betty used
to
strip.
You're talking to a 45-year-old man who could give one fuck about pussy, honest to God. I don't give one fuck. I just turned 45, realistically. Useless.
So yeah, we have Billy Friedkin coming on in a few minutes. It's Billy Friedkin. We're gonna be talking about his new movie Killer Joe, which you got to see. It's got Matthew McConaughey, Emile Hirsch, Gina Gershon, Thomas Hayden Church. It's NC-17. It's supposed to be violent as shit.
Nice. I like a little gratuitous violence.
It seems like one of those cult movies you're going to be playing on your Tuesday night.
I'll tell you this. Well, maybe.
You should have a Billy Friedkin night.
I would love to.
Exorcist and French Connection.
The Exorcist was one of the finest horror films ever fucking made.
Yeah.
Honest to God.
It's the best.
It scared the piss out of you.
Yeah.
In fact, My kid, this is a couple of years ago, but he's like 12 now, whatever. But my point is, I was on eBay, and I saw the fucking Exorcist for Super 8. And I'm like, I got to have this.
Wow.
This is like the greatest thing that ever fucking happened. I'm getting the Super 8 Exorcist. Here's the deal. Super 8's only went 17 minutes, so what they did is they took the best fucking parts. It was just basically Linda Blair's fucking head. You know, fuck me, all that, whatever. My point was, the kid had a little fucking Halloween party. I said, okay, we're going to have a little tent. I got this, like, we're underneath right now. In fact, it's the same goddamn tent. We put sides on it. And he had a little Halloween party, so he'd invite all your little sixth graders over. You know, we're going to watch little monster movies and all this bullshit. Sure enough, I said, we're going to run fucking movies. I put on The Exorcist on the 8mm. It's fucking hilarious, man. All these kids eating hot dogs, they never saw a fucking horror film in their life. I put on The Exorcist. As soon as it fucking, her head started fucking spinning around, I had this big Mexican, a fucking Lupe, he had a fake chainsaw on the fucking, he kicked in the fucking door, started chasing these kids around. It was hilarious, man. I mean, this is YouTubeable funny. However, the video didn't come out, but listen to me, they fucking screamed. Those parents called me for like 3 weeks after this. Like, they don't fucking sleep, the kids can't sleep. No, The Exorcist, one of the finest horror films that was ever pieced together. Honestly,
yeah, it's best. The best. And then, so Billy Friedkin's going to talk. Joe Carnahan's going to call in. We're going to talk about why you should not go to film school, among other things. And Ronnie, thank you for Cigars and Stripes today. We had a blast.
Well,
I was saying I should do the show here more often. I didn't know it'd be so much fun.
No, it's nice. Listen, I just want to just point out that I've never seen a bunch of full-grown men drink like pussies before in my life. And the beers were free at this time. But listen to me. Once those microphones come down, you guys are paying. Fuck that. Hey, listen, Matthew, I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Ronnie,
thanks,
you're the
Ronnie,
best.
Ronnie, thank you for having this spot here. Thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to be wrapping up here. This is the Matthew Aaron Show. You can find us on iTunes at the Matthew Aaron Show, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter, the Matthew Aaron Show on Facebook. You can like us there.
I want to say happy birthday to Alex Luisi.
This comes YouTube. The Matthew Aaron Show's on YouTube. Luisi, where's Luisi? Happy birthday on the 9th. My dad's birthday was yesterday on the 7th.
Hey.
No one cared. No one came by.
Nope.
It was just me and my dad lonely sitting watching
something.
The ball game.
Yeah, because you sit there and waiting for the phone to ring, just assuming people have telekinesis.
I do. Nobody's calling. Lenny didn't give a shit. Nope. Enjoy the Billy Friedkin and Joe Carnahan.
Yep.
And we will see you next Wednesday, because odds are I'm going to be dying and I'll still be in Chicago. Okay.
All right.
Good night. Okay. This is Matthew Aaron. I am here with Billy Friedkin, William Friedkin, of great, great legendary director status. You may have seen his work in The Exorcist, French Connection, The Sorcerer, Cruising, Jade, Blue Chips, the list goes on, Bug, and he has a new movie coming out today. Well, this is airing Wednesday, so last Friday, Killer Joe, which you can check at Century Cinemas in Chicago. I know that's the location out by me for sure. In L.A., I'm sure it's playing at a few theaters. I'll look it up and I'll announce them later. But I'm here with Billy, and I... hi, Billy. How are you?
Hey, Matthew. How's it going?
I'm doing okay. I'm trying to stay calm here and not get all angry and stuff, but we're having some audio difficulties, so our listeners know in case there's any problems. But, Billy, you're doing Killer Joe here with a great performance. It's getting rave reviews from Matthew McConaughey's performance. I guess my first question to you right out of the box is, Matthew McConaughey is somebody who I think was very underrated for a long time, and if you ever watched him on talk shows, he was very intelligent, and I kind of wanted to get an idea from you, what made you think outside of the box to cast Matthew McConaughey in this dark role?
Well, okay, Matthew, you're breaking up, but I think I can make out what you said. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you perfectly.
Okay. I never saw any of his earlier films except Frailty. And then later, after we worked together, he did The Lincoln Lawyer.
Yes.
it came out after we had worked together, but he filmed it just before. But I saw him, too, on an interview program. It was either Larry King or Charlie Rose. And I was very impressed with him as himself. And he spoke about how he grew up, and he grew up in Texas, right around the place where this story is set. And his accent was perfect, and his insight into these characters, which he discussed in this interview before he knew anything about Killer Joe, I realized that he was like a perfect choice, but unexpected, in that he's very charming. And I was originally going to cast a guy who was much gruffer, more of a grizzly bear kind of a guy. And when I saw Matthew on the interview, I thought, no, this would be a unique way to go. And I'm pleased that it turned out that way, you know, that he read the script, which he initially didn't care for, but then he thought about it, and he realized how funny it was and how disturbing, and so we met. And we met for a couple of hours at his house and found we were on the same page. But I had never seen any of those films for which he's best known.
No. And I was going to ask you, originally you said he didn't like the script. What didn't he like about it?
He didn't get it at first.
Okay.
He read it straight. You know, as many people may not get it, you know, there's a certain tone to this that is kind of unique to just a handful of writers, not very many at all. Like Tracy Letts.
Yeah.
And Matthew didn't pick up the tone right away, but he thought about it, and he reread the script, and he found the humor in it as well as the truth, and so he told his agents, maybe he'd better meet with me.
That's great. And
so when we met, we realized that, you know, this was a picture we both understood and wanted to do.
That's great. And Tracy Letts, of course, is someone who's very well known at the Steppenwolf Theater here in Chicago. You have a background in Chicago as well. First, I guess, what's your background with Tracy? He, of course, is a great playwright and also an actor. Maybe you can expunge on your relationship with Tracy Letts.
I saw Bug in around, I think, 2005 or 6, I saw it at the Barrow Street Theater, an off-Broadway theater in the West Village, Greenwich Village of New York. And it really impressed me. And I immediately saw a film in it. And so I got in touch with him. I found out who represented him and where he lived, and I told him I was interested in doing a film. I asked him to do the screenplay, and we had a great relationship with that. I love his writing, and I felt very attached to his ideas about paranoia and obsession that run throughout Bug. And so then we stayed in touch. I came to Chicago and saw him do a couple of plays. I saw him do The Dresser there at Steppenwolf. We kept in touch. And then in about 2010, he called me and said, hey, I wrote a script on Killer Joe. You want to take a look at it and see if you're interested? And he sent me a screenplay, and I thought it was brilliant. Yeah. So I said, look, if I can cast this right and find an interesting producer, I'll do it.
And it turned out that you were. Now, did you agree to do it before you casted it?
Sure. I knew I would cast it somehow.
Yeah.
And I took a lot of wrong turns with it, I must say. There were a lot of people interested, and I was about to go with them, and a very funny thing happens to me. It happened on The Exorcist, on The French Connection, on To Live and Die in L.A. I was going to go in a certain direction with the casting, and one thing or another didn't work out, and I wound up with an ideal cast that I had not even originally thought of.
Yeah.
For example, Juno Temple. I'd never even heard of her. I was going to go with, what's the girl's name who's in, I didn't see it, but she's in The Hunting, the...
Oh, Jennifer...
Jennifer Lawrence.
Lawrence, yeah.
I was going to go with her, and I think she'd be great. But then Juno Temple sent me an audition DVD. She actually emailed it to my casting director.
Yeah.
And she auditioned for this part unsolicited with her 10-year-old brother playing Joe. And I thought she was fantastic.
Wow.
Just great. She was exactly what I was looking for, and so I went right to her. Then with Emil Hirsch and Thomas Hayden Church, they were my first choices, obviously. And then I pursued a number of other actresses before I realized that the only one who had the courage and the ability to play this was Gina Gershon.
Oh, she's amazing. Great actress, Gina Gershon. I was going to say to you, though, that this is why I love you, though, is because you and a few of the guys from that era of filmmaking in the 70s, you take risks, and someone like Juno Temple sends you an unsolicited DVD, and you're totally open to looking at it. Some of the directors nowadays in this more corporate world of filmmaking, they wouldn't do that.
Well, I've always, you know, had good fortune doing that. I remember when we couldn't cast The Exorcist at all. We had auditioned several thousand 12-year-old and 11 and 13-year-old girls around the country, including Chicago. A lot of young girls put themselves put on tape by casting directors, and there was nobody that seemed right. And we started to look at 15 and 16-year-old girls who looked younger, and that wasn't going to work. And just as I was at the point of despair, where I thought I could never cast this role, which meant not make the film, Linda Blair's mother brought her in to my office in Warner Brothers in New York, and unsolicited, again, she didn't have an appointment. I was at my desk, and my secretary buzzed me and said, "There's a woman out here named Eleanor Blair. She doesn't have an appointment, but she's brought her daughter and wonders if you'll see her." And the rest is history, as they say.
Oh, that's a great story. Now, on the flip side of that, I've always heard, and I'm one of the biggest fans of Roy Scheider on the planet, for The Sorcerer, I always heard that it was going to be a totally different movie with Steve McQueen, a totally different cast. Is that a situation where it didn't all come together for you, or were you still happy with the final product?
No, I love Sorcerer.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
And I thought Roy was great in that and The French Connection and many other films, like All That Jazz. He was a really great film actor. But we wrote the script, Wally Green and I, for Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
And Steve had just started his relationship with Ally McGraw, and he didn't want to leave the country. And I had the locations all picked out in the Dominican Republic and in Mexico. And I was very arrogant at the time, and I thought, well, hell, Steve wanted me to write in a part for Ally McGraw, which I didn't do, or bring her on as associate producer, which I wouldn't do, and not leave the country, because he didn't want to be away from her. And all of those things I would have done today.
Yeah.
Because I didn't realize at the time, as I do now, that a close-up of Steve McQueen's face is worth more than the most interesting landscape you can find. And so if I had Steve McQueen, I would have also have had Marcello Mastroianni and Lino Ventura.
Wow.
But they would not do the film with Roy. They would not take second or third billing to Roy. And so that cast fell apart.
No.
But It was written for Steve. And Steve, after he read it, said, this is the best script I've ever read. Now let's talk. And so that's when he asked me to accommodate his then wife, Allie McGraw, and I wouldn't do it. I tell you, I would do this absolutely today.
Yeah, I think I'm 28 years old, and I think being younger and in that kind of situation, you hear that you want to add your wife into the movie when you say it's a perfect script, and you're like, well, you said it's perfect. Why am I going to add a character? You know how much goes into writing? I mean,
well, that was the conversation.
Oh.
What you've just improvised is how it went. But, you know, look, Steve McQueen, this script was written for Steve. Now, I thought Roy was great.
Yeah.
And the other guys as well. But it just didn't have, you know, the same charismatic feel as the cast that I could have put together had I retained McQueen.
So for you, what is so, we talked about Gina Gershon, how amazing she is, Emile Hirsch. What did you take from working with this cast on Killer Joe? What was the set atmosphere like? What were their methods to working with you?
No, it works like this. The most important thing a director does is choose the material he's going to do, which means spending a year or more of your life with this material.
Yeah.
In the case of The Exorcist, I spent over 3 years with it. From the time I first signed on to do it until when I finished doing all the foreign versions and supervising them and then doing press. It was 3 years. Nothing but that. The second most important thing a director does is cast the film. If anyone is off or wrong, the film's not going to work, no matter how good the script. And the third thing, most important thing a director does is create an atmosphere on the set.
Yeah.
Where the actors and the crew can feel that they can find the characters and find the movie within themselves. You're creating an atmosphere where they don't feel that you're being judgmental. They don't feel that you're an adversary, but you're supporting them, and you're giving them the courage to create. And those three things, choosing the material, choosing the cast, and creating an atmosphere where they can find the characters and innovate, it's probably 75% of what's important about filmmaking. The rest is putting it together.
Yeah.
Both the editing, the picture, and the sound.
And
that's what I did. I was more interested in spontaneity from the cast than perfection. So I had talked to all of them at great length before we went to the set, before we went to shoot the movie. And I learned from them, certain things about themselves that would provoke different emotions. And then I was able to draw upon that knowledge of rather private things regarding them that would provoke the emotions of these characters. In other words, the sense memory that leads to anger, love, vulnerability, fear, whatever it may be. And so I would occasionally employ my knowledge of certain things that would provoke those emotions in them.
Yeah. Now, over the years, people have stated that you have controversial methods for doing that, such as firing a gun or whatever the case may be. Do you feel your methods are controversial? Because I don't really. I think you're bringing out a performance in the actors, and maybe not other directors do it like that, but I think you've brought a bunch of acting nominations to the Oscars, so something must be working.
Well, what you're talking about, the first time I ever heard, first of all, I never fired a gun on the set that had real bullets. I mean, you fire blanks off stage to provoke only a response of fear or surprise or shock. And the first time I heard anyone had ever done that was an article that I read when I was much younger. It was in the old Life magazine, and it was about George Stevens, the great American director, and one of the films he made, Shane and Giant, but he made a film of The Diary of Anne Frank. And in order to provoke the people in the attic set where the Frank family was supposedly hiding from the Nazis, whenever he wanted them to fear that the Nazis were going by right outside their window, of course there were no Nazis, yeah, and they were filming on a set, he would hang out above the set and fire blanks into the air. And that would provoke the response of fear and tension in the cast. And so I started doing that, and I did it on maybe three or four films in order to accomplish the same thing. Because if you're an actor in a film, you can't produce shock or fear or whatever it may be from a dead start. You have to, you know, the director has to help you. No. Because if the camera's on you and you're supposed to be looking at something terrifying out of camera range, what you're looking at is not terrifying at all. You're looking at the crew back there. And some of them are reading the newspaper. Some of them are drinking coffee or having a chat. They finish their work. And you're not looking at the thing that is supposed to be provoking the emotion.
Yeah.
So the director has to provide it in any way that he can. Now, if you have a wider shot and you have actors in the same frame and they're playing off one another, you don't need to do that. So I wasn't, you know, firing off blanks on a constant basis. I was only doing it to provoke suitable reactions during closer shots.
Well, and I guess the reason I bring that up is because someone I consider kind of a tabloid reporter, but I guess he wrote a few books, is Peter Biskind. And, of course, he didn't have flattering things to say about you or your friends. Now, I heard you never gave him an interview for that book he wrote. I won't even mention the title.
Well, first of all, I read a recent interview with Peter Biskind.
Yeah.
Wherein he said I was the most cooperative guy that he talked to. And he really liked me. And I'm surprised because... Excuse me, I have a cold.
No, no, that's fine.
And a cough, but I may have to stop from time to time. But I read this recently. I spoke to Peter Biskind once for about a half hour. I don't think I ever spoke about any of the things he wrote about, although I have to say this. I have never read his book through. I've glanced at it, and as have some of my friends, like Coppola and Spielberg and others who I've talked to, who feel the same as I do. In making that book up, what he did for the most part was talk to ex-wives and ex-girlfriends and people who had an axe to grind.
Yeah.
And so they gave him a lot of stories, some of which were true, some of which were completely false or made up, and others which were rumor. So his book, I imagine, is a combination of all of that. But I never did any kind of in-depth interview with him, and I don't know that the others did either. He did come and see us, I think, in order to say that he did, in fact, meet us. But what I read about myself in that book, the very few things I read about myself, are a combination of truth, lies, and rumors.
Yeah. Yeah, I figured as much. And that's it.
Now, you'll get the same response if you talk to Scorsese, Spielberg, Coppola, because they talk to people, as I said. He or his researchers, I'm not sure who, you know, were looking for controversy, and they knew we weren't going to sue him.
Yeah.
I don't know if he implies at all that I used drugs during that period, because I have not read enough of his book to know that. But I, in fact, have never even tried grass or any other drug. I've never, and I know he did suggest that some of the other guys were into drugs.
Yes, he did.
I think his book is called, isn't it called The Decade Under the Influence?
Yes, it is.
No, it's Easy Rider's Raging Bull.
That's the subtitle of it, was Decade Under the Influence, I believe.
Well, anyway, the implication is under the influence of drugs.
Yeah.
And so if that is the subtitle, and I'm not sure that it is, but it seemed to me that what he was getting at was that, you know, the young guys of my generation were into drugs, and perhaps many of them were, but not around me. I never saw it. I was like a narc, you know, when it comes to anyone doing drugs. I had no, and still have no tolerance for it, whatever.
I'm sorry, Billy. I just remembered A Decade Under the Influence is the documentary based off of his book that he did. So you were right. I mean, we were in the ballpark.
Yeah, well, I know that the general feeling of the book, as I've discussed it with some of my contemporaries, is that.
Yeah.
And the influence was drugs. Now, you know, in my case, there is absolutely nothing to it whatsoever. With the other guys, I really don't know. Because we all, you know, we were friends and colleagues, and we'd see each other from time to time, but not always.
Right.
So I don't know what their private lives were like when I didn't see them. But I know that they all feel, as I do, that Biskin's book is really made out of whole cloth.
Yeah. How do you feel that college professors at film schools put that book on syllabuses for kids to read?
I didn't know that they did.
Yes.
But it's unfortunate. First of all, nobody should be in film school today. All you need to do to learn how to make films is to watch them.
Yep.
And to especially watch Alfred Hitchcock's films, because they are a veritable lexicon of filmmaking. And today, if you're a young person interested in making films, you can do what I couldn't do. You can go out and buy a camera now, an affordable camera. And you can shoot something, and you can edit it at home on your computer, and you can then, if you get something, even if it's a short film, you can put it on YouTube or some other site. People will see it, and even there's a lot of young executives in Hollywood who watch this stuff, and guys have gotten job offers as a result of it.
Yeah.
I think that that's a more practical way for someone to learn how to make films than listening to theories or having somebody criticize your work. Because all criticism of your work, even by the best film professors around, is subjective.
I agree.
I know that. Have you ever heard of a rock group called The Doors?
Yes.
Well, these guys went to UCLA Film School, and Ray Manzarek and Jim Morrison were told that they had no talent as filmmakers. So they started cutting class, and they would meet on the lawn at Royce Hall at UCLA. And Morrison used to read his poems to Manzarek, and Manzarek said, "Jesus, these lyrics are great. These are songs." And he wrote music for them, and they started this band. I can only imagine what their films must have been like. You know, I would love to see their films. And I've often, you know, I've made mental notes to try and get into the UCLA archives to see if any of their stuff survives.
Yeah.
I know the surviving Doors, Manzarek and John Densmore. And I've made a mental note to try and look at their student films. And Robbie Krieger, who was the fourth member. But they were discouraged from being filmmakers by the professors at UCLA.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I always get into arguments with people that just because you don't like somebody as an actor doesn't mean the rest of the world doesn't. And the truth of the matter is, criticism is all subjective. And the truth of the matter is, what really matters is if people go see the movie or not. That kind of judges the most. That's the best judge on if a movie's good or not, I think.
Well, but you're talking about process, the process of making it.
Yeah.
And today, virtually every young person who can afford to go to a film school can afford to go out and make his or her own film.
Yeah.
And when I started, when I wanted to do this, you couldn't do that. There were none of these little cameras around that shoot high def that you could then take the output and edit it on a computer. You know, you had to apprentice somewhere where this equipment existed. You know, it was all 16 or 35 millimeter negative, and you had to really have a job on a film so that you could apprentice and eventually get to a point where you could make a film. But you don't have to apprentice anything anymore. And you can learn. The principle of learning film is by watching other films and deciding for yourself what you like, what you don't like, and then not copying it, but being inspired enough by it to do your own thing.
Yeah. Well, what
the message of the great filmmakers to young people, the message of Orson Welles, who made Citizen Kane, to aspiring filmmakers, is make your own Citizen Kane.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, though, because you were saying, Billy, you were saying things that you can't do now that, or things that you can do now that you couldn't do back when you started. Well, it's kind of the opposite for us, because people that grew up loving your films and, I mean, there's very few guys nowadays that can make the kind of films that you used to make in the 70s. No one wants to make $20 to $30 million movies anymore. They just don't want to make them. And that's kind of a turnoff. That's why I've gone into acting, because I'm like, all right, well, I want to be in this business real bad, but I can't direct the kind of movies I want to direct right now.
I think you can.
Yeah?
Look, there are many examples. Killer Joe's a very low-budget film, much lower, by half, lower by a fourth. And Bug was even less expensive. And there's a little film out now called The Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Oh, what a great movie.
Which was made for very little money. And there were, even during the 60s and the 70s, there were guys like John Cassavetes who were mortgaging their houses to make films.
Yeah.
And they were made for very little money. And that's true today. Did you see The Beasts of the Southern Wild?
Yes, it's a great film.
Well, that's, I don't know how much it costs, but
not much.
Very little.
Not much.
Very little.
Great.
And I know that it was shown to the guys who work up at ILM, George Lucas's company,
yeah,
in Mill Valley, and they loved it. And they did the post-production work on it for virtually nothing.
Oh, wow.
And the director and his associates, they got grants from various organizations to make the movie. And they came out with a wonderful little picture that doesn't cost the catering budget on the average blockbuster. And that's true of Killer Joe as well.
Yeah.
And it was true of Bug. It's not, there are many smaller budget films being made today, but not the mainstream pictures. You know, the mainstream films are based on comic books and video games, and they cost, upwards of $200 million.
You know,
and then they spend another $150 or more to market them.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I was going to ask you, speaking of that, that's very interesting. You have never really done a big blockbuster mainstream alien movie or superhero movie. Was that ever an option for you? Did you ever think about doing one of those?
No. I don't think in those terms. By the way, I love the movie Alien. I think it's one of the most frightening films I've ever seen. I think it's brilliantly done. But The French Connection cost $1,800,000. And it was budgeted at $1,500,000. So I went $300,000 over. And they wanted to kill me every day because I was, you know, $300,000 over budget.
Yeah.
And some of the other great films of that era, I don't think The Godfather cost $3 million.
Wow.
None of the important films of that decade cost a lot of money at all. All that's changed for various reasons. The high salaries that stars get today, CGI, which is very expensive, although it can accomplish anything a director envisions, but it's not cheap to use it. But there are any number of reasons why films cost more money. Everybody makes more.
Yeah.
All of the craft unions, you know, everything is much more expensive today than it was when I started out.
Yeah.
And the great classics that preceded my era, they cost even less.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, now, do you feel there are just as...
Look, Citizen Kane cost a little over $1,000,001, and it went over budget. Casablanca cost about that, and that had big stars. So the guys who worked in the 30s, well, from the silent era up until about the late 70s, those guys knew exactly what they were doing. And they didn't have the technical facilities that you have now. They had to do everything that you saw on screen manually, physically. They had to do it. They couldn't do it on a computer. But they knew exactly what they were doing. And, like, for example, the greatest chase scenes I've ever seen in my life were done by Buster Keaton at the turn of the 20th century.
That's very
And up until around the mid-20s. There's no chase films made that can even approach what Keaton did in films like Seven Chances and Steamboat Bill Jr.
Yeah.
And The General and so many others. I mean, the genius of filmmaking was back in the silent era. And those of us who came afterward learned everything from them.
And Billy, would you say, because I get this sense, I guess everyone could say this kind of affected the way movies were made forever, but Citizen Kane had a major effect on the way you were as a director, correct?
Oh, well, you know, none of my films even come close to Citizen Kane. What it did was inspire me, and it continues to inspire me. It inspires me to try, well, all I can say is to do the best I can. You know, there's no reason to even think about trying to top Citizen Kane, but it has inspired a whole generation of filmmakers here and abroad, as have many other films, but especially Kane. In my travels, I find that Kane is the most influential film. Now, this generation, today's generation of film students and filmmakers, they know very little about Citizen Kane, frankly. I go to a lot of film schools and talk there, or to film societies where they run some of my films, and I'll find that a lot of the people there were influenced by Star Wars and,
yeah,
you know, the Terminator,
yeah,
and other stuff from, you know, that is more contemporary. So it was my generation that was influenced by Citizen Kane. This generation has many, many other and different influences.
Well, Billy, would you mind if I called Joe Carnahan really quick and included him on the conversation?
Sure. Why not?
All right. I know Joe wants to speak to you. I don't know how it's going to work. Let's hope it works.
Hello.
Joe, you there?
Hello?
Joe, you there?
Hello, Joe?
Yeah.
Hi, Joe. Billy Friedkin here.
Billy, how are you, man?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good, brother. You in Chicago with Matt? What's going on?
No, I'm on the phone from L.A. Where are you?
I got you, brother. I'm driving my children up north to Petaluma, California, to see my wife jump horses.
Cool.
Which is a thrill of mine, but I can't tell you how happy I'm driving 7 hours.
That's a nice
teenagers. It's fantastic.
It's a nice drive, though. I don't know if Matthew's. I don't know if Matthew's still on. Matthew,
yes.
Are you still on?
I'm here, Billy. I'm here. I thought
okay.
I'd let you two talk.
Yeah, well, as you know, I'm a huge fan of Joe Carnahan's. Narc is the best cop film I've ever seen.
Wow.
See, that's
by far.
But that's like, yeah, man, that's like, we have a gigantic mutual admiration society, because it's like every time I think of, like, a ballsy, like, the you know, like, I, you know, getting all the flack for ending The Gray the way it ended, and I always thought of To Live and Die in L.A., which I absolutely adore that film, and think, and Billy, I think we've talked about this, there's something, that film kind of represents to me, like, the death of the 70s sensibility where you could, where, you know, directors still kind of called the shots, and you could do things that were very outre and unexpected, and the idea of killing Bill Peterson off and, you know, finishing the movie with John Pankow, who's like the secondary character, to this day, man, is one of the, like, the great, just ballsy moves. That's why I'm dying to see Killer Joe, man. I've heard just the greatest things about it.
Well, thanks, Joe. I think you'll like it. I think it will appeal to your sensibility. But, you know, I got in touch with Joe, Matthew,
yeah,
after I saw Narc. It just blew me away. I didn't think you could make a film like that.
Yeah, I remember you saying that to me, Billy. Yeah, I remember you saying that. Like, I don't know how to make that kind of movie, which I thought was hysterical, you know.
Well, it was
coming
so
from you.
No, I mean, it was so real and so on the money in terms of the sensibility of cops. It was
right.
There was no artistic distance between
right.
The reality and your film. That was it. It was like a documentary.
Right, well, that's, I mean, listen, it's like, again, it's in the spirit of, you know, what you guys were doing, you know, what the French Connection was, which is just, you know, it's funny, I try to cite that film and that, and you know, all the time as we try to cast new people and try to break out of the, you know, the five names that you must acquire to make a movie these days. And Matt, we talked about this on the show,
yeah,
you know, that it's getting more and more difficult, but yet back then, you know, Roy Scheider, who wasn't a name, Gene Hackman, who wasn't a name, you know, you put these great guys in the film and then surround them with Egan and Grosso and these, you know, and guys that were, it's just, it was a completely kind of immersive experience. And I think we got to get back to that because I just think it was such a wonderful, unique time to an exploratory and you could try things and, you know, and God damn it, I miss it, you know, in that way.
Joe, I don't think we're ever going back to that. It's heading
right.
in the opposite direction. You
yeah.
know, the if the film business today, the Hollywood aspect of it, is star-driven, it's also technology-driven. It's not driven by story and characters anymore
no.
as it was in the 70s and before. I remember Dick Zanuck, who was head of Fox, who died recently,
yeah,
and he's the guy who let us make The French Connection. He said to my producer and me, he said, you don't need stars in this movie. He said, just get the right actors. Get actors that are believable. And
sure.
that's why we were able to make the film so inexpensively and shoot it like a home movie. But
right.
he didn't need stars. Hackman was not a star. He had
right.
really good supporting roles, you know? But
sure.
Zanuck, let me use it. And that was basically the drill in those days. It isn't anymore. You don't need to
right.
make a film necessarily with stars, but you need to have big visual effects and, you know.
Well, Billy.
Well, no, you're right, Billy. And I think we go. Go ahead, Matt.
No, I was just going to say, based off of that, Billy, I don't know if you've seen The Gray or not, but Frank Grillo is just a guy that reminds me of those guys from the 70s, like Roy Scheider and Gene Hackman. He has that kind of talent. He has that kind of presence. He's not a name, but, man, is he fucking great in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, it's important. You know, this is the guy I was actually mentioning. I was trying to get him a part in this film. It was a lead, and I thought if I surround him with these other guys, I think the guy has got tremendous, I mean, he's a man in a business that's rapidly running out of them. And I thought he was an ideal kind of piece of casting. And Jesus, I just fought tooth and nail. And I realized, like, we're not going to be able to push this because the foreign sales, which drive everything now, you have to have these quote-unquote actors. And I think, Billy, that, to me, these guys, you know, the business tries to hedge a bet. It's impossible to hedge. It's like for every time that they think, oh, if we put this actor in this movie, it's going to be profitable. You know, I'll find you five other instances where there's you know, actors that have no name. I mean, The Hangover is a perfect example. You know, it's like that was a modestly budgeted by Hollywood standards comedy. Nobody knew those guys at the time. But because the movie was funny, it succeeded. And I think people are, I hope audiences are getting more savvy to that. But the more we feed this kind of the blockbuster superhero mentality, the tougher it's going to be to make those kinds of films. You can definitely see a fork in the road. And you're going one way with the big tentpole, you know, it's got to make $500 million domestic or it's a failure. And you're going the other way, you know, with movies that are going to be under $20 million that, you know, that are going to have to find a niche and find a place and hopefully find an audience. But I think it's getting...
You're right.
You know,
and occasionally, one of those slips in, like this Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Right,
you know,
right.
Those people had never acted in a film or possibly anywhere else. But that's
sure.
A marvelous little film. I don't know
I
exactly
that. Yeah,
what
I really want to see that. Yeah,
oh,
I really want to see that
great.
Film.
It's a great little movie. It's exactly what you're talking about. The lead is a six-year-old African-American girl, you know, and I think the guy who plays her father, who's the co-lead, was a baker down there
God.
In Louisiana.
That's
and
amazing.
They just cast him because they were right, but they made the film for such little money, but it happens to be good, so it broke
right.
through. Now, it's
right.
not going to
exactly.
make as much money as Total Recall, you know,
sure.
But
sure.
but it'll do all right.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm
right.
encouraging young people to do.
That's great.
You know,
yeah,
go out, get it, pick up a camera. What, you got to have a vision, and you got to have a story. And that's really all you got to have, because you can now get the equipment, Joe, that was not available to you and me when we started.
Oh, no, there's no question. I mean, I tell people all the time, it's like you're right. You know, people have run out of excuses because, you know, the cameras they have now, the HD cameras, I mean, that Canon 5D I've shot with, that looks as good as I cut that in with 35 millimeter on the gray. You couldn't tell the difference. It's, you know, I think
absolutely.
It's, you know,
I used
becoming,
the,
you know.
I used it, too. There are cameras smaller than that, and you can make a film if you have an idea, and you can edit it yourself on your computer at home, and you can get it run on YouTube or somewhere, and people will
absolutely.
See it.
And
absolutely. I know guys who got jobs off of doing that. But,
oh, sure.
That's another paradigm that's available to young people today.
Yeah.
Right. The idea to have exhibition and get your stuff seen. It's never been easier than what it is than it is right now.
Right.
I mean, ever. It's so, and you're like you say, Billy. But I think, listen, in any given situation, the cream will always rise to the top. And if you've got good filmmakers with a good story, a solid script, and you get good performances, then it will break through. And you know, it happens time and again.
Yeah. Well, you need a lot of luck and God's grace, though.
Yep.
Yeah, you
to
do.
Have a picture.
Sure, you do.
You know,
absolutely.
Be seen by enough people. You know,
absolutely.
And you need ambition. You know,
yeah,
that
you do.
You
need to, yeah.
You can't
yeah.
learn ambition. You either
no.
have it or you don't. And ambition comes out of believing in yourself. If
right.
you don't believe
yeah,
in
yeah,
yourself,
yeah.
but you have talent, it's not going to rise to the top. So the first thing I think an aspiring filmmaker needs is ambition. You know,
right.
You got to go out
right.
and believe that you can do it and that you have something to say that's worth doing.
Absolutely.
Sure. And I think second to that, and almost as important as drive, you know, and the ability to push in spite of obstacles, in spite of naysaying, in spite of all the things that will drag you down and encumber and hinder that process. You do. You need to really, because I know. Listen, I name five friends of mine off the top of my head who I think are exceptionally more talented than I am, but they don't have that other gear. They don't have that ability. They don't have that ambition. They have the talent,
yeah.
but they don't have that mechanism that allows them to get that out there, and it allows it to kind of tirelessly. I mean, it's a pain in the ass, man. It's a lot of hard work. It's a load. You gotta pick up your feet and keep moving them. And some guys don't want to do that.
Did you guys know who Richard Brooks was?
No.
Richard Brooks, the actor Richard Brooks?
No, Richard Brooks, the director. He made Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Okay, yes.
He made The Professionals. He made, I don't know, a dozen great movies. He made In Cold Blood. One of the great directors.
Oh, God, Richard Brooks directing Cold Blood? I don't know why I didn't know that.
Yeah, Cold Blood and Lord Jim.
Oh, yeah.
Jim.
Wow. And many others. And he was a good friend of mine. He passed away, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. But he and I were very good friends. And I went with him once to a film school where he was speaking. And a kid asked him, what does it take to become a film director, Mr. Brooks? And he gave the best answer I've ever heard. He said, you got to learn how to eat shit. And he was absolutely on the money, because what he meant was, you are going to find so many people along the way in the studio system that want to, quote, help the director, unquote.
Right.
That want to give you notes. That want to tell you who to put in the picture. That want to tell you what to take out of the picture. And even a guy like Brooks and all of his contemporaries, as important as they were to Hollywood, they had to go through all that shit. As did
right.
I and all the guys from my generation. There's so many people, and I know you find it, Joe, that want to tell you how to make a movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's infuriating. And I think even when you give them, you know, the thing that they want or the thing that they purport to want, that doesn't mean that the marketing and that the way and their release date and all the things that come post that are ever going to, you know, are going to work in your favor. There's so much of it that's out of your control. But when that part of the process is screwed around with, and it's this constant second guessing and constant, you know, it's like, listen, I'll give it to the guys at Warner Brothers. They know enough to get out of like a guy like Nolan's way, just let him do his thing. And it doesn't feel like that those movies are micromanaged. And so you get something that for the superhero genre is at least interesting, or like at least it's trying to do something different. But, you know, for the most part, you do. You get these meddlesome kind of personalities, and they need to justify why they pick up a paycheck every week. And they become, and you know, listen, they become these kind of cogs, but none of them have a real opinion, and none of them, I've never, you know, I've had a handful of guys I thought within the studio system that were really sharp and really opinionated, and without fail, they last about 3 months, and then they're out of there, you know, because that does, they don't encourage that kind of thought, they don't encourage that, that spirit of like, well, let's pull for the right thing, which is the movie. You know,
most of the films that are made within the system are made by committee. And that's
right.
I think what Brooks was talking about. They're made
right.
by committee, and they have to push certain buttons. And that's something that for the most part independent film doesn't have to deal with.
Right.
You
Which
know
I think, how did you find Billy Making Killer Joe? Was it just you and your producer, and that was who you had to deal with, or did you have the process of the, you know,
there was no studio. The guy who financed the film had financed the Hurt Locker. And I asked him, you know, he's a guy named Nicholas Chartier, and he made the Hurt Locker when nobody would have was interested in making it. And I asked him, how come you made The Hurt Locker? Why did you make it when everybody else turned it down? And he said, I just wanted to work with her. I thought she was a good director. And, boy, you don't hear that. I mean,
no,
I know she is a great director. I think she's as good an action director as there is. And
I agree with you.
She had a tough time getting films made because most of her earlier films, you know, didn't register with audiences. I know that when my wife, you know, Sherry, when she was running Paramount, she tried to get Catherine Bigelow onto a lot of films, and she couldn't do it. You know, she could, the cast wouldn't work with her or whatever else.
Right.
Or, you know, and Sherry always believed in her, and as do I. And then she nailed it with The Hurt Locker, so now she's solid. But there was a time when she couldn't get hired, and she's as good as anybody around shooting action.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. I agree with you, Bill. I think she's just as good as anybody. And even early films like Point Break and the Blue Steel thing she did with Jamie Lee Curtis, and I thought she did. And she did Near Dark ages ago, and I think she is. She's extremely adept at that stuff, and it's kind of shocking because of, who knows, she's a woman, who knows what the hell kind of idiotic reason people would have for not giving her the
talent
to move. Absolutely.
You know,
and proved it, you know.
She had the talent, but, you know, she hung in there, too. She believed in herself against all odds, you know. The odds of a woman getting any film to direct in Hollywood are great against, and especially an action film or something like The Hurt Locker. I find that, you know, and then what's really interesting, though, is that the whole industry recognized The Hurt Locker and voted for it for an Academy Award over Avatar. You know?
Right.
And she didn't have the catering budget of Avatar, you know? So, but she hung in there. Because she was around, as you know, for years making good pictures.
Right, absolutely. But this goes to what you're saying, Bill. This goes to that idea again of, you know, ambition and drive. And another part of that, which is obviously perseverance. You know, you need to, you know, not listen to, you know, those around you that say you can't, you know, and keep telling yourself you can, and you know, no matter how thick that wall gets, you got to keep blasting against it until it comes down. And that's it really does. It just comes down to, in the simplified version, your confidence in your ability in yourself, you know, and what that means to you.
Billy,
and that's how you measure
it. It's easy to get frustrated. It's very easy to become frustrated. But if you love it, you know, you stay with it. That's all I can say. But as I said earlier to Matthew before you came on, was you don't need to go to film school today. Did you ever go to film school?
No, hell no. I went to San Francisco State. And I went to Sacramento State. I was at State College. And my brother, who's a screenwriter, went to USC but didn't take a single film class. So. And you don't. I take nothing away from fine accredited universities like USC and NYU and so on. But I just think it's I tell people this all the time. You want to be a filmmaker, go make films. And
that's it.
And you know, this idea of theory, and I think that's wonderful. And if you have access to those types of courses, and you can get in there and, you know, take a film history course. But it's not. You know, I think you can educate yourself just as well, especially with Netflix and with, you know, all these things, you know, online. You can watch anything. Jesus, you want to see something from, you know, Seijin Suzuki or some kind of obscure Japanese, you know, filmmaker, you can dial it up. And,
that's
you know,
right.
When you couldn't do that.
No, we
10 years
do
ago.
That.
You know,
the only way,
you could do that.
The only way we had access to film history was if some revival theater was playing something.
Right.
And they couldn't play as much as, like, Criterion has put out there, you know?
Oh,
as
absolutely.
A,
right.
You know, now,
absolutely.
You can look at a list of the great classic films that are out there, and I'd say 98% of them are available. And
absolutely.
When I was trying to see some of these great foreign films or silent films or something like that, nothing was available. Nothing.
Right. Right.
If it wasn't playing at some local theater in Chicago, I couldn't see it.
You couldn't see it, no. And then now, it's true. You can. You can. you know, you can literally, anything you want to see, it's at your fingertips. It's on your computer, you know, or on your PlayStation or your Xbox or whatever. It's just so, and that's the thing. I think what's great about that is, if you're a young filmmaker, whomever, you know, you don't have excuses. You've run out of excuses because technology has simplified everything so much that you can really, what you can do, as you mentioned earlier, Billy, sit on your laptop with a simple HD camera, digital camera, is remarkable. It's better than anything I could have shot on 16 millimeter, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
That's exactly right.
You know, better quality, better sound, you name it. It's all digital. There's no, you know, I sure have analog stuff. I mean, we used to do little three-quarter U-matic videos and then take them through DV, take them through like a Grass Valley switcher to make the film for, you know, to kind of flicker them and make them look like film. It's like, you know, like you just have just, I mean, God, what iMovie will do, which is something you just get on your Mac, is better than any editing program I had. So it's just, it really is like the rubber has really met the road in that way that, you know, it's so simple. And if you really want it, you got to go get it.
You need that ambition and drive.
I agree, Joe. And I love the gray, by the way. I didn't get a chance to talk to you, but you live.
Oh, that's fantastic, brother.
You live here in L.A.?
I'm there, Billy. We got to go get some chow here, man. What part of town are you in?
Absolutely. We're leaving tomorrow morning, really early. We're going on a fly to Iceland, and then we're going to fly from there to Turkey, and we're picking up a boat. We're going to cruise around Turkey for a while. I won't be back here till August 17th, but I'll call you when I get back, Joe.
Give me a shout. That'd be great, Billy. That'd be fantastic. And tell Sherry I said hello, and, you know.
I sure as hell will, Joe, and keep up the absolutely first-rate, great work you're doing.
I appreciate it, Billy. I appreciate it. Matt, you guys be good, and I'll talk to you guys down the line, man.
Joe,
okay,
I'll
drive carefully,
you.
Joe.
Okay, so long, guys.
Thanks, Joe.
God bless.
Bye-bye.
He's the best. he is one of my favorite people on the planet, Billy. I love him.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy.
He's a
no
great
question.
Guy. He's a great guy. He's smart. He's got a ton of energy. He's ambitious. He's driven like you were talking about. And I guess the two questions I was having when I was listening to you guys talk, I was a young pup just taking in the advice. But now for younger people who want to go to film school, and you guys are like, don't go to film school, just shoot films. Watch Hitchcock. Learn from the best. Okay, how do they explain to their parents that they're not going to go to film school, or that they shouldn't go to school at all and they just want to shoot films? Or is that just part of the ambition and drive that you kind of say to your parents, look, you don't get it, I got to do it my way?
Yes, that's a part of it. You know, I would not have said this, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. I wouldn't be saying don't go to film school. No, absolutely not. But now, there's no reason to. Now, you know, everybody who is teaching a film course or something is going to hate me for saying that. But I do speak at a lot of film schools. And I think that very often the criticism that young filmmakers get is totally subjective. And what they're exposed to is not necessarily the opportunity to innovate and create. You know, they mostly seem, in my experience, to see films that are way beyond their reach in terms of budget and facility. And, you know, or they'll see, like, some of the classics they're shown, like Cassavetes films, which you can't recreate. I don't know where the kids who made The Beasts of the Southern Wild, they may have gone to film school. I don't know. I'm not saying that very talented filmmakers don't come out of film school. They do. Many do. And in that sense, it is, you know, worthwhile, because you can learn the basics. And as long as you don't have instructors that are squelching your creativity, but encouraging it and your innovation, As long as you have instructors that are encouraging it, that's fine. The point I'm making, though, and that Carnahan was making, is you don't need to do that. There were no film schools when I started, nothing.
Yeah.
You had to get a job, an apprentice. You had to apprentice to in some minor capacity and work your way up. But you had no access to the equipment. Today you have total access to the equipment. So better to access your own vision, and your own imagination, and just go out and shoot film if you love it.
Yeah.
It's not going to be 35 millimeter film anymore or 16. It's going to be high def. But, they're not going to make 35 after this year. So you've got to get used to the new equipment.
Yeah, they're bankrupt. Eastman Kodak's bankrupt. They can't do it anymore. So it's going to be digital.
Yeah, well, they're still Fuji, but yeah. Most of the theaters are converting to high def.
Right.
Whether you like it or you don't like it, or you have a nostalgia for 35 millimeter, I wasn't sorry when the 33 and a third LP disappeared and became CDs, because to me the sound is better. Now, not everybody agrees with me, but that's how I feel. I seldom, if ever, listen to any of my old 33 and a thirds, let alone 78 RPMs, because the sound is so much purer and cleaner on CD.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how I feel about high-def film.
But at the same time, I kind of feel like there's a place for vinyls. There's a place for 80s and 90s and 70s and 60s and 50s film, black and white. I mean, because it's an experience.
Yeah, but, 35 millimeter has a death certificate attached to it.
Right.
The prints fade.
Yeah.
The quality gets lost. And they were never a perfect medium to begin with. You always had imperfections in the water that went into the developer. You always had fluctuations in the electricity that went to the printers. And so I supervised the prints of all of my films. And one reel might come off yellow, the other would come off green, and it took forever. It was almost 25 to 1 that,
wow,
that would allow us to get an acceptable reel in, let's say, a 12-reel picture.
Oh, I had no idea.
We throw away 24 to get one.
I had
because
no
of the imperfections of the developing and printing process.
Oh, I had no idea about that. That's crazy. wow. But what about the filmmakers that argue that because of the equipment is easier to gain access to great equipment, digital great equipment, that it's easier for them to make these terrible reality shows, or they don't pick up or what about the filmmakers that don't that complain about how they don't pick up lower budget movies for mainstream audiences? I mean, obviously, like Beasts of the Southern Wild, like we talked about, it will find an audience, it will make money, it probably has made money already, and it's a great film, but some people would be frustrated that it's on 4,000 screens.
Why would they be frustrated?
I think some filmmakers are like, a great small film like Beasts of the Southern Wild, we want to see that on 3,500 screens. Why isn't that on 3,500 screens? And I just think that's some of the attitude towards it.
I don't know that it needs to be. It's on an awful lot of screens now, and it will be on a lot more. And there's no limit on it now.
Yeah.
I don't know how many screens it'll get to, but it's already increased drastically the number of screens it's on. It's playing all over the country. It's in any number of theaters.
Right.
Because it's got I think it's a PG-rated film. So it doesn't have a limit on it. And anyone who wants to see that film will be able to see it, unless you live in a very remote part of the country where there might not even be a cinema.
Right. And I was going to say, I guess the better question to ask you then is with your wisdom throughout the years and through all your experiences you've had, when should a filmmaker be happy with his film? Should he be happy that he just made the film and that it got a release, no matter how many screens? Should he strive for it to be seen by as many people as possible? When should a filmmaker be happy with their final product?
Boy, that's a great question, and it depends on the individual. There are a lot of people who are making films because they want to become successful at it. And success, as I say, is a matter of luck and the grace of God.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are people who have, I don't want to name them, but I think many of your audience will know who I'm talking about. There are many filmmakers who had films that didn't work and just stopped doing it, dropped out, or couldn't get it done anymore. And then there are others who pick themselves up and move on to the next one. I'll give you, there's a wonderful verse that Samuel Beckett wrote that I'm using as in the frontispiece of my book. You know, I've just finished my memoirs
for
HarperCollins.
Yeah.
And I use this quote from Samuel Beckett in which he says, "Fail. Fail again. Fail better next time."
Yeah, that's how you learn. I mean, I've done this show now. I've done 120 of these shows within a year, and each one has small failures.
You'll fail better next time.
Yes, I will.
And that's how you have to look at it. But not everyone can. If you have delicate sensibilities, you sure as hell don't want to be in the film business.
Well, we're just lucky to be alive. Yeah,
I agree. Well, yeah, start with that.
Start with just being lucky to be alive and then do what you love to do. I mean, I'll just be flat out honest. I don't make any money doing what I'm doing. I just want to promote the people I respect, the people I love. I want to learn from them, and I want to promote their products that they have coming out. And I do this because, yes, I want to get ahead in the business. I want to network. I want to meet people. I want to get opportunities. And hopefully I'm lucky enough that that happens. But, I mean, I do this for free, and I do this to fail all the time. And I'm just happy to be doing it, though. And I agree with you about the failure, though. I'm happy to be doing it. I'm happy.
Well, just fail better next time.
I will fail better. I was going to I have so much to talk to you about, but, Billy, I want to ask you, when's the book coming out? Do you know?
Next spring from HarperCollins.
So that's going to be next spring. I'm really looking forward to that. I mean, I love a great biography, and the fact that you wrote this yourself, I think it's going to be great.
I wrote the book in longhand in these moleskin books, and then I would get about 50 pages written at a time, and then I'd read it into a micro cassette recorder and have it transcribed, typed, and then I'd correct the typed version 7 or 8 times and then send about 30 pages at a time to my editor. And now I've finished, and they've accepted the book, and I've even sold it in Italy already, and it's about to be sold in other countries at the Frankfurt Book Fair. But I haven't written the last chapter, which is Killer Joe.
Oh.
I have yet to process that experience. As you know, the film just opened around the country today.
It opened today, and you can see it at Century Cinema Theaters in Chicago. You can see it in there's 5 or 6 theaters that have it in L.A. You can see it all over the country. I mean, it's getting a limited release, I think, in part because it's NC-17. But I get a feeling, Joe, I get a feeling, Billy, that Killer Joe, you don't give a fuck that it's NC-17. I kind of get that feeling that you're just...
No, it's the right rating.
Yeah, I just kind of get that feeling.
It's absolutely the correct rating. The only question I have is, why are there films out there that are much more violent and have much more graphic sex, you know, like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which shows anal rape, you know, graphically, and has violence like you can't believe? Why does that have an R?
Yeah.
And the answer is simple. It's been put out by a major studio. And the ratings board belongs to the major studios.
Yeah.
So they will always be able to make frame cuts or shot cuts or whatever of a very minor nature that will allow the ratings board to give it a less draconian rating. But if you've got an independent film that, you know, pushes the boundaries, that's not going to happen. And I would have had to destroy Killer Joe in order to get an R-rated film out of it. And we're not targeting young teenagers anyway.
Yeah.
So we figured, you know, what for? What the hell?
If it was a studio, they would have said, but starring Matthew McConaughey and Emile Hirsch, we need to target this to teenagers. But the fact that you did independently, I think you got to be happy with the final product. You got to make what you wanted to make.
Yeah, exactly. And I believe it is the correct rating.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, and we'll get into this another time. Hopefully we can talk again. But I got to ask you, did you have NC-17 issues with Jade? Was there ever a possible X with Cruising?
I never. The only film that I had to cut severely for the ratings board was Cruising. And that I put in 40 minutes of out-and-out pornography that I knew they would cut in order to preserve what I wanted to preserve. I put in stuff that I knew they'd cut, and they did, and that allowed me to get an R rating and still tell the story that I wanted to tell.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the one I was thinking about. So Jade was never like that, though, and you really...
I had to make some frame cuts in Jade, nothing severe.
Now, Jade's one of your favorite projects you've ever
nothing
did.
Nothing that hurt the story or the characters, but yes, we had to cut some frames out. Nothing out of The Exorcist. That ratings board, they gave it an R rating without one frame cut, a half hour after they saw it.
Yeah.
And I never had ratings problems with anything else either.
Did you ever see the film Bully, the documentary that came out this
year? No, I have it here. It's not a documentary, is it?
I think it is, yeah. There was the Bully, the movie.
Oh, yeah, the Harvey Weinstein,
yeah.
I was thinking of another film called Bullhead, this Belgian film, yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, I never saw Bully. I know about it.
Yeah.
And, nobody can game the system better than Harvey, you know. I don't know if the film should have gotten its original R or not.
So, yeah.
I know they cut the four-letter word out of it a few times, and they got a PG-13. I didn't see it, so I don't know.
Okay, well, by the way, my producer, Pat, wanted us to know, Beast of the Southern Wild was shot on 16mm. It had a crew of 65. No name actors. It cost $1.3 million and sold to Fox for $2 million. It has grossed $5 million thus far.
Right, and look, a lot of the finishing costs of that film were donated by ILM.
That's great. And
they finished their soundtrack and a lot of visual effects at ILM.
And that's why people need to sometimes George Lucas. You know George Lucas, so. I mean, is he's got to be a great man. I just assume he's a great man and a great guy for the film business. And I know he gets a lot of shit nowadays, and I don't think he should.
Well, if he does, he's very comfortable dealing with it, I assure you. I don't, George Lucas is beyond taking any shit,
Yeah.
He never has to make another film himself, but he keeps going. He keeps pushing the technology so that others can make films. And he does things like help them complete the soundtrack of Beasts of the Southern Wild and other films that they feel are worthwhile.
That's great.
And so, yeah, Lucas has given back as much, if not more, than anyone I know.
And that's special, and that's, I love that about him. And I guess I'll ask you one more question off topic, then we'll plug Killer Joe. And I know you're not feeling well, and you're going on vacation, so I'll let you go get ready and stuff. I was going to ask you about Jade, and a reason I was going to ask you is I just got done reading a book that I'm kind of ashamed I read, Hollywood Animal, a memoir by Joe Esterhaus, and... He did not have kind things to say about you in that book. Have you heard it? Have you heard what he said?
No, I haven't. You know, Esterhaz is not a rational man.
No,
to me.
Okay, that's what
and,
I was going to ask.
And Esterhaz is a very angry man. He's filled with rage and bile, and he's basically out of the film business.
Right, and I was just going to ask you, how is it that you love Jade so much? Because I heard Jade is...
I know, not how is it, I do.
No,
and
no.
I liked his script enormously.
Oh, no, but that's not what I'm asking,
you know,
Billy.
Joe is the kind of guy who could not stand failure.
Yeah.
And if there was anything around him that failed, he had to blame it on somebody else.
Okay, that's what
it is. The studio, the director, the whatever. It was never Joe's fault. And he had a great run for a while.
He did.
He had a good run, and he had a genre that he virtually owned. But I haven't read any of his books.
Okay.
You know, I'm too busy reading literature to read Joe Esterhaz's books. Where I don't know the titles of them.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed that I read it. But
well, you're probably interested in schmutz.
I
understand that he's written a book about his, you know, recent relationship with Mel Gibson. That is also probably, you know, self-destructive more than anything else. But I shouldn't say that because I haven't read it.
Yeah,
but I've heard people talk about it. And that's what Joe does now.
Yeah.
Joe is settling scores that he doesn't even need to deal with, you know. Because I don't have any scores that I need to settle with Joe. And I'm sure that Gibson doesn't either.
Yeah.
Whatever happened between them is over, and they moved on. Or Gibson has, but Joe hasn't. So, you know.
Well,
I guess if someone will publish a book that attacks people, it's more interesting to them than publishing a book about promoting somebody.
Yeah, I agree. And look, I like reading books about Hollywood because I guess growing up, you know, always wanting to be in the business and be an actor and to direct and write. And then so I kind of wanted all the stories, you know, and sometimes there's good stories.
I can safely say there are interesting books. There's some interesting biographies of Hitchcock and Welles, and they're worth reading. There are others. But they're not books that are primarily gossip oriented,
yeah.
You know, or written in the style of the National Enquirer or Star magazine. That's not what you want to look for.
Right.
I venture to say, this is only a guess, that there you will learn nothing from a book about Esterhaz's problems in Hollywood.
I learned absolutely nothing. I hate to say that, but I did. I learned nothing. And I was just, I just remembered, you know, and my question was, and you answered it, but I wasn't saying, how could you like Jade? Jade's a great film, but I was just wondering how you liked it so much and he thought it was such, and it's because, you know.
Well, he didn't, I don't know what he said about it, but he sure liked it at the time.
Well, his quote.
And he thought it was going to be a great hit.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he wrote the screenplay. And I love what he's done.
Yeah.
I have no problem. And I didn't have any problems at the time with Esterhaz. In fact, he certainly, during the production of the film, he wasn't even that involved in the casting or the production or anything else. But I kept him apprised of everything.
Yeah.
And he was off, you know, doing his own thing, whatever that was.
So are you going to be doing another opera next, or are you going to be doing another film?
I have no plans to do another opera. You know, that could change. I've done, I don't know, about 12 or so in the last 14 years.
Incredible.
But I am looking at some film ideas, and I'm... You know, I don't know which one I'll do next, to be honest with you.
No, that's fair. I was just always curious because I know about you directing operas, and I would love to see one that you direct. I think that'd be great. I was going to ask you, and then next time we talk, because I really hope there's a next time, because I want to get into your Chicago background, because we come from similar backgrounds. You worked at WGN. I mean, there's so much I want to talk about, but...
Well, I'll get back on the 17th of August,
yeah,
Matthew, and you can call me after that, and we'll set up another time. How's that?
Billy, I think that you're the nicest guy ever. Mike Binder wanted me to tell you, by the way. Mike had dinner at your house with his godfather a while back, and he wanted me to tell you, he says hello, and he says you're one of the nicest guys he's ever met. So,
well, he was great, too. I remember that evening, and I haven't seen him for a while, but please give him my warmest regards.
I do my show out of his restaurant, so maybe we could set it up where you and Joe can come by, and we could talk about film for a while, and I'm sure Mike would love to see you.
Great. Look forward to it, Matthew.
Thank you, Billy. And Killer Joe is in theaters this weekend. It'll be playing for the next few weeks. Go out and see it. It's in a limited release. Matthew McConaughey, Emil Hirsch, Gina Gershon, who's fantastic, and Thomas Hayden Church. Please go see this film. It's important. It's a great film. Thank you so
much,
Billy.
Thanks a lot, my man, and I'll talk to you like mid-August.
Yeah, have a good vacation.
Thanks a lot, man.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon.
Be well.
Okay, thank you.